The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 84, recorded April 4th, 2012. The one where we didn't say goop. Well, welcome back to Digital Campus. This is episode 84. I'm Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org, and I've got with me today the regulars, Dan Cohen. Hey, Dan.
How are you?
I'm good. Dan's at dancohen.org, of course. Amanda French. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tom.
And Amanda is at amandafrench.net. And Mills Kelly. Hi, Mills.
Hey, Tom.
Mills, you can find at edwired.org. Well, it's been a couple of weeks, and we have some stories that we should cover. There's a story that's been in the news for a while now that we haven't, I don't think, talked about, and it has to do with publishing and Apple and a lot of the things we like to talk about here. We had hoped to get our friend Tim Carmody of Wired on the show, but Tim, at the last minute, had to bow out for some conflicts. But Tim's done an awful lot of good writing on this story, and we'll link to his work in the show notes. But the story is a Department of Justice investigation, or apparent Department of Justice investigation into Apple and five of the big six trade publishers, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Penguin, among others, for collusion in pricing of ebooks. And what the Justice Department is looking into is whether the kind of simultaneous switch of these publishers from an agency model to a wholesale model, and we'll go into what those terms mean.
Actually, I think it's the opposite way around.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. From a wholesale. Yeah. Right. The other way around represents collusion. Dan, have you been following this, and what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we'll get Tim on a podcast in the future to get into some of the details more. But this was actually, if you've looked at Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs, he actually talks about this switch. And there's several layers of irony here. You know, basically what was going on was that Amazon was very fast out of the gate with the Kindle. Started selling a lot of ebooks. In fact, it still has a majority of the ebook market. I think some estimates are around 65% to 70%. Amazon, just with their print book business, was operating under a wholesale business. In other words, they would buy books wholesale from these big publishers at whatever price they would get. If the publisher said, "We're going to sell you this ebook for $15. Amazon, just with their print books, they can have sales, they can price it at whatever they want. And what they decided to do, which irony number one, was a lot like what Steve Jobs tried to do with music, was, hey, let's just have a low price of $9.99 for most ebooks, with some exceptions like academic market ebooks. But he, you know, Jeff Bezos priced these at $9.99, even if they were a loss leader for Amazon, which is a very common way that Amazon operates. They've got a bunch of businesses that are in the red for years until they pay off. But it was very disturbing to these big publishers because they felt that in the same way that the 99-cent song was very problematic early on to the big music publishers, that it was going to sort of create a mental model, buying model for the consumer where an ebook was $9.99 and you couldn't sell it for $15.99 or $19.99. And they were really worried about their profits and Amazon's market pressure because they had already gotten a majority of the market. So Walter Isaacson, when he interviewed Steve Jobs, he actually got pretty much the full story, which is Steve Jobs went to these publishers and said, let's switch from the wholesale model to an agency model, which is effectively the way that Apple runs a lot of its app store business. They take 30% and the publisher or the app maker gets 70%. And they set the prices. And the maker of the item, whether it's an app or an ebook, sets the price, and whatever the consumer pays for that, they pay 30%. They get 30%, Apple does, and the publisher gets 70%. And the publishers, you know, like this because now, yes, they're giving up 30% to Apple, but they can set the price of an ebook at whatever they want. And when this happened 2 years ago, if you're an avid ebook reader, you notice that a lot of the books immediately went from $9.99 to $12.99 or $14.99. And, you know, I think the publishers felt really good about this. You know, the repercussion, of course, was that Jobs acted, and this is where it gets into kind of technical Department of Justice legalese, but he acted as what's often interpreted as a kind of hub and spoke model of collusion, where there's a kind of middleman who's talking to all of the supposedly independent price setters, in this case the publishers, but who's sort of telling them what the other publishers are doing. So he goes to all these publishers and says, you know, this guy over here, he took this agency model and he's probably going to be pricing his books at around this level and your profits will go up. And all of a sudden, all of them had exactly the same model at the same time for the rollout of the iPad in 2010. So, you know, I think for a lot of people, even just on the face of it, it is a little bit odd. I mean, it led to higher price books for publishers. But I think what we're wrestling with right now, and I think what's worth discussing on the podcast is, you know, is there any real way to unwind this that is helpful to all the parties involved and not just Amazon? Because Amazon would love it for this model to be rolled back to wholesale. They can drop the prices to whatever they want. They can put market pressure on the publishers. And they're selling a whole lot of Kindles. And people who buy Kindles buy a whole lot of ebooks because it really is a single-use device or a near single-use device. So, you know, I think where we are right now is there's a lot of worry among authors and publishers that, you know, if this agency model is overturned, and it does look like in the negotiations that's what's going to happen, that they're going to lose the pricing power and thus the kind of profit center for some books, and that it will just create a 800-pound gorilla in Amazon that everyone will fear. So a little hard to know what to do, especially since, you know, well, if this model is overturned, theoretically and probably in reality, ebook prices will go down, and that's great for the consumer. So, a lot of tensions here, and it's a little unclear what the outcome will be.
Dan, can you explain to me why this wouldn't also benefit Apple? As you know, I mean, the iPad is probably number two in terms of the platform that people are using to read off of, and so why wouldn't this encourage more iPad sales?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, actually, the Nook is number two for ebook sales again because there's these devices that are really oriented toward reading. They're extremely popular. I think for those of us, I mean, I've got an iPad and I think it's great, but I think we underestimate how many books are read on Nooks and Kindles, you know, it's a really good question about does it benefit Apple. I think, you know, Apple really likes this 30% cut of everything. I think it's just like an incredible model for them. And I don't know if you remember, but when the App Store went live in, what was it, 2008? Remember, there was no App Store when the iPhone launched. When it came out, everyone was sort of speculating what cut they would take. And I saw lots of ranges that it was going to be 5%, 10%. And then they said it was going to be 30%. And their stock like immediately started surging because everyone realized if they could actually get 30% of everything that's put on an iPad, that's a really awesome business for the long run. So hard to know what to say about that.
Right. I mean, so there's sort of two, there's at least two issues at play here, right? There's this issue of whether there really is an agency model here. And I think that question has broader implications for Apple's business model in general. So the idea of the agency model is that that the Apple is just serving as an agent for the publishers. They're just kind of a pass-through and they take a cut. But normally in an agency model, I mean, they're making an analogy to the analog world where in an agency model, let's say, you know, if you're a bookstore, if you're selling on with an agency model, is you don't actually own the stock in your bookstore, right? The seller owns the stock, and then when you sell something through your storefront, you take a cut. The alternative model, the wholesale model, you do own the stock, right? You own all the books in your store, and so you can set the prices. It seems to me that where this falls down, or where it allegedly falls down, is that there is no stock with digital goods, right? There's no this analogy between agency and wholesale breaks down because there really is nobody holds any goods. There's no kind of liability. And so this whole question of whether these analogies work, it seems like is key to this. And if they don't work, then what does it mean? What does that mean then for Apple's, not just the iBook store, but for the App Store? Am I reading that right?
I mean, I think that's mostly correct. Although, you know, you got to remember that with the book business, right? Books were shipped to Barnes & Nobles and the former Borders, but could actually be shipped back. So there were cases where this sort of like gets a little bit inside baseball, but where actually, you know, Borders and Barnes & Noble and Amazon didn't really like own the stock outright. In other words, they didn't like pay a wholesale rate and just have it sit around. In fact, Amazon made a lot of money early on just from what they call the float. They would sort of get these goods like books but not pay the publishers for them until like 60 days later, and then they would sell them and immediately charge the credit card to people, and they would just make money on like the $1 billion that they had in that 60 days,
right?
And all the financial instruments they could put on that. It's a complicated business, but I think, Tom, you totally put your finger on it. You know, with an ebook, there are infinite copies. There's not storage, real storage costs. These things are microscopic digitally. And so I just think there's this huge power struggle right now going on. I don't think we had planned to talk about this, but, you know, the Pottermore launch, recent launch last week, mm-hmm. also plays into this, right? So here you've got J.K. Rowling who – you know, wants to maximize her ebook profits from the Harry Potter series. And so basically sets up her own store so she can act as her own agent, right? She doesn't want to sell her books through the wholesale model, right? It's all about the, you know, the pricing competition. And, you know, we should note as a sidebar that there's a class action lawsuit against these publishers and Apple for the increase in prices after they went to this agency model in 2010. So, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, again, tensions and probably a pretty good court case, two good court cases against this collusion. So I think something's going to change. But the question is, you know, I think the publishers are freaking out because it basically means that Amazon, I mean, most of the estimates are that they will instantly make over $1 billion more on ebooks in 2012 if what happens, in other words, and if the agency model is destroyed.
You know, go ahead, Amanda.
No, you go ahead, Mills.
I was just going to say, I was going to make a snarky comment, which is that maybe the executives of some of the big recording companies could take some of the executives of the big publishing houses out for a dinner, you know, and say, welcome to our world.
Because, I think that's,
you know, this disintermediation that's just what's going to happen.
Right. And you go ahead, Amanda.
Well, just what's interesting is that to me is that from a consumer point of view, there isn't competition anyway. You know, price is only one aspect of this because so many of these things are dependent on particular hardware. Like they're DRM, it's proprietary format. So in some sense, it doesn't matter to me if, you know, I can get a book on the iPad cheaper than I can get it through Amazon or vice versa if I only have an iPad or I only have a Kindle. You know what I mean? If you can get the same book for, you know, a lower price on a device that you don't have, that's, you know, a whole lot more money because you have to buy the device. So there are other aspects here that they, hopefully the Justice Department is taking into consideration besides price.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I think the real problem with Amazon, or one that we've discussed on the podcast before, is they use a completely different binary file type than the iPad, the Sony Reader, the Nook. They don't use this international standard of EPUB or EPUB plus DRM. Yes, they're DRM'd on all these platforms, or at least most of the books are, the commercial books from these publishers. But Amazon's got its own file type, and you get locked in. And, you know, by all accounts, you know, these Kindle readers are going to be $49, $29 by Christmas 2012, and then you're buying all your ebooks from Amazon because you sort of have to, unless you want to lose all the books you've bought. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's one of these tough questions of a kind of near monopolist or a company on the way to monopoly versus a bunch of scared executives. And Mills, I think your comment's exactly right, right? This is like Apple after the iPod, right? In, you know, 2003, 2004, where 90% of the MP3 players sold were by Apple, and 90% of the digital songs sold were through iTunes. And then, you know, the feelings of these executives at, you know, these music companies when Steve Jobs shows up and tells them that they have to price it at 99 cents, you know. So he did throw a bone to them later and let them raise it to 129. But, when he made a little bargain over DRM. But still, I think, you know, there's just these sort of natural monopolies or lock-ins that you get. And I wonder how the Department of Justice is weighing that.
I think it's interesting, the different sort of, they all want lock-in, right? But the different kinds of lock-in that these companies are shooting for. So, you know, Apple wants to lock you onto the device, right? They want to have you buy your stuff through the iPad, read your stuff on the iPad, and, you know, buy another iPad when the new and better one comes out. Amazon has a different kind of lock-in. They lock down the file format, but then they make it available everywhere. So you can read, you know, the Kindle store and the Kindle app is available on every single platform. You know, I mean, even on platforms that not that many people use anymore. I mean, it's on RIM, it's on everything. But you have to use Amazon's software to read it, even though you can get the software anywhere. So it's interesting that they all have these lock-in models, but they're just slightly different. And it'll be interesting to see which one wins. Well, we'll have to get Tim on to talk about this some more. I think he can probably correct us where we've gone wrong and add some insight to the discussion. But moving on, we also another kind of big company monopoly story. We saw that Blackboard, the learning management service software provider, is moving into open source with the acquisition of a couple of companies that support open source competitors to Blackboard, so Moodle and Sakai. And so Blackboard is going to, I suppose, start supporting those open source competitors to its own software for universities that I want it. I think we're all open source advocates here. We're all open source enthusiasts and evangelists here on the podcast. Is this a good thing for open source or is this a bad thing for open source, Amanda?
I think it's a good thing. I have to admit, when you put it that way, Yeah, I think it's a good thing for open source. I think it's, I do think it's the term open washing has been thrown about, Blackboard is not really in principle committed to the values of open source and all that kind of thing. I think there's a lot of justice in that. But yeah, on the whole, I think it's not so much that this move is a good thing for open source, although I think it might be, but that this move signals how important open source software is and that Blackboard recognizes that. And I do think that, most of us probably know that if you are going to build a business model off of open source software, it usually is in the support services. Like, you don't actually sell the software, but plenty of people can make a good living off of supporting that open source software. Blackboard recognizes this. Now, I guess one of the questions is Blackboard going to, did it acquire these companies that support Moodle in order to shut them down? And I don't think they did, actually. I think that they did buy them in order to keep providing that support for Moodle and I think Sakai as well. But we'll have to see about that. I could be entirely wrong about that. I think it's a good thing for open source if Blackboard continues running these companies as they're currently configured, which is as open source support companies.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I thought some of the coverage, as you did, Amanda, was a little bit overblown with, there was some rhetoric as, Blackboard owns open source, these open source products, Moodle and Sakai. And I think that's a little strong. I mean, of course, they don't own Moodle and Sakai. They own companies who provide services around Moodle and Sakai. And just as, I think that the existence of Red Hat has been good for Linux, I think the existence or Blackboard's participation in the open source community and providing support for people who really, people don't want to run that, people don't always want to roll their own. People want help with that. Is good for open source. Mills and Dan, do you guys have a different opinion or you see this as essentially a good thing as well?
I would say call me suspicious.
Yeah, me too.
Call me suspicious. I'm gonna adopt a wait and see on this one, just because and it's not that I suspect Blackboard for any particular reason. It's more that I worry about very large companies that have a very dominant position in any market than moving into open source until proven otherwise. I mean, I can be proved wrong. I'm not saying I'm right or wrong. I'm just going to adopt a wait and see, because it's either that they've, as you say, suggested, Tom, they've kind of figured out open source is really important to their business model and so a good thing to support and invest in and build business around. And it could be really advantageous for the developers, who now foreseeably will have better access to the Blackboard platforms, which are really important to the education market. And so that could really lead to some positive things. Or it could be that this is an anti-competitive move and there's just no way to know at this moment. So I think ask me again in a year and then I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, as a historian, I think I like to go by the history here. And Michael Chazin, who's the CEO of Blackboard. And we should remember that now this is like a company that's owned by private equity. We're not going to get a lot of insight into what's going on behind the scenes in terms of revenue from these various divisions. But Michael Chazin has been a very smart businessman, and he's bought out in the past lots of other competitors, right? I mean, I don't even know if I've got enough fingers to count all the competitors for learning management systems that he's bought out. WebCT, there was one before that, the Angel Fire stuff, or Angel system. They bought – I mean, he's just continually buying these other companies to decrease competition in this area. And I don't know. So I'm count me a little cynical when he also buys support companies for open source. I would think if you're in the business of maximizing your profits, then a good thing to do would be sure, buy the support systems for the open source and then have your salespeople go in and say, well, you know, you could keep supporting Moodle or you could upgrade for $100,000 a year to Blackboard. It's really best in class. Which one would you like, you know? And clearly, he's been a great salesman. I mean, I'm continually amazed that universities just like pony up for Blackboard, considering what a kind of lousy web app it is. So I'm much more on the skeptical side. And I also think, you know, especially since we run some big open source software projects here at the center. And by the way, if Blackboard would like to buy us for $1 billion, I think we'll take that. Am I right?
Man,
I need to talk about my stock
option. I am just laying that out as director of the Center for History. We will take $1 billion for Zotero. And we'll throw in Omeka.
Yeah, we'll throw it in, right, exactly.
As long as they don't
buy one, get one free.
Right. So, you know, I think having looked at Zotero and Omeka, a lot of what goes on with open source is like about optics. It's about the way the community like sees your project and
yes, that's true.
Openness and transparency. And so I think things like this where, yes, it like gives the support services more resources and things like that. But when they also like buy out one of the leading evangelists for I can't remember his name right now. I should have pulled up that article. But they also Dr. Chuck, right. So, awesome. You know, they're also buying out one of the leading evangelists. I think it just looks really bad to the community. And then that leads to a decrease of engagement with coding and free support that goes on peer-to-peer in open source communities. And so I think it has the potential just on the optics thing. I know this is a very like meta argument about it, but I think it might hurt Moodle and NetSpot? What's the other one?
Moodle Rooms and NetSpot.
NetSpot, right. Thank you. I think it's just going to create friction in that community, and I could see bad things happening, whether that's a fork or a kind of situation where they just don't upgrade the software that frequently and keep up to date and all that stuff.
I've got to admit, I don't really know of any institution that, you know, and this is just my own ignorance, but I don't know of any institution that uses these services. I mean, when I think of open source, I think of projects like Zotero and Omeka, where both the software and the support is free, and the support is all done by volunteers. And in that case, having that software or that, and its associated community sold to Blackboard by an evil director such as Dan Cohen would be, you know, a terrible thing and would sort of kill the products. But I don't know how many institutions are adopting Moodle or Sakai and then paying for support. So if they are doing that already, they probably won't care that these pay for support services are supported by Blackboard, I guess, right? They won't have that same kind of open source community because they won't be relying on the volunteer support. They'll be specifically paying for support. So they're just paying somebody else and they don't really care.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And we should recall, and I think I've brought this up on the podcast before, but Blackboard is more than just their LMS, their learning management system. They also, like at Mason, the Blackboard system runs the cafeteria checkout computers and the card swipe machines, you know. So they have ways of getting their tendrils into different parts of campus and you know, this might just be a move for them where they could say, oh, yeah, you've got Moodle rooms and, you know, why don't we do your cash registers as well and take a cut of that.
But I guess I'm thinking of things like WordPress, where there is such a lot of free support for WordPress, but there are also premium, for-profit groups that will write you WordPress themes or write you WordPress plugins or sell those to you or whatever. And it all sort of exists in this hybrid economy, and I think there's room for that too.
And Omeka has a little bit of that.
LMSs.
Yeah, Omeka has a little bit of that too. One difference I think in these markets between something like WordPress, something like Omeka, and something like Blackboard is the customer. For WordPress, for Omeka, for Zotero, the customer is the individual, and the individual has much more flexibility in making choices. And I think the market for the marketplace among individuals is runs much more smoothly and or more efficiently, and it's kind of more of a classic marketplace. Whereas the customer for Blackboard are these big, slow battleships of institutions, and so the market is pretty inefficient. And once you know, there's a lot of lock-in. So I think that that sort of speaks to, you know, I still am optimistic, but that does speak to the other side of things. I guess this is something that we're going to have wait and see. It's I really like that there's some disagreement on the podcast. Normally we're all in the same place, so that's a good thing. Disagreement. We should have more of it.
I disagree.
Like
disagreement.
We're gonna have to take this offline. I think something we can all agree on, however, as a good thing, is the release just this week of the 1940 census, and not just the data, but a lot of tools around it. Have you guys had time to play around with this?
Yeah, I found my great grandparents. On my mother's side, my mother's grandparents who came over on a boat and lived in the Lower East Side and then over in Brooklyn. I think I tweeted this out, but I mean, it's so cool to, you know, make your way through the census logs, and then like I found their specific address, and then I dialed that up on Google Street View, and it's like, bam, you know, I could see where my great grandparents lived in 1940. Very cool.
Yeah, and I solved a mystery in my father's family that years ago I tried to help him work out about parentage and you know, birth certificates and things like that. So that was kind of helpful.
Mills, is this something that's going to be, you know, I think that the research uses are in some ways kind of obvious, but something you're going to be able to use in the classroom?
Well, I actually use genealogical resources in some of the local history stuff that I do, and so right away it has that kind of use. And then I think, you know, were I an American historian, I think I would have, you know, tremendous use for it as a social history resource, because there, you know, it's this giant data set that now we get to play with and that nobody's gotten to play with before. So, in that sense, you know, were I teaching those kinds of sort of, you know, America in the 20th century courses, it would be really exciting.
Can I say there were two aspects of this release that I found really interesting, and I'm not a historian. You know, I have a doctorate in English, so this isn't the kind of data that I usually work with. But I was surprised, number one, by how immediately hugely popular this was. So the archives partnered with a private firm, archives.com, to release the census in a nice browsable website, and they blogged something to the effect that we expected a flood and we got a tsunami. They had that that typical internet mark of success where they were so successful that the website broke.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody could get onto it. And I think that took everybody a little bit by surprise in a good way. You know, this was so popular, partly because they did just a great job of advertising it, and the website is really nice.
Beautiful.
It's
beautiful.
Oh my gosh. I mean, yeah. Anyway, so the second part that I thought was just really neat, and again, unusual and unprecedented, was what the New York Public Library did. So the New York Public Library was building an app, you know, with this data and with its own resources, which you can then find at directme.nypl.org, it's called Direct Me NYC 1940, where they took a bunch of digitized old phone books from the 1940 and built, again, an amazing website that lets you look up somebody and find their address in this 1940 phone book, and then convert that into a census enumeration district and find all of their census data from that 1940 thing. And then this you know, New York Public Library website, I mean, they've got headlines from 1940s New York Times streaming in. So they partnered with the New York Times, you know, for that. I mean, just brilliant stuff. I mean, this I'm sure did not happen at the release of the last census 10 years ago. I just thought it was so exciting.
Yeah. And really those kinds of things, you know, some of it is not open data, but it really shows the potential of open data and open APIs to be able to kind of, you know, very sort of very easily create these kinds of mashups is just very cool. It's kind of the, you know, 5-10 years later, the promise of Web 2.0. Well, I think, you know, that's something I think we can all be excited about, and I think something we'll all probably use in different ways in our research and teaching and even just, you know, personal family history stuff. Well, something a little lighter to close out the show. Have we talked about fake Elsevier yet on the podcast?
I think it may have come up, but
yeah, I think it might have.
Not
I think
their
it might
most
have come
recent
up.
Yeah.
Exploits
so,
and troubles.
So fake Elsevier is one of these fake Twitter accounts. You know, there's fake Steve Jobs and fake Shaquille O'Neal and, you know, these kind of parody Twitter accounts where they're tweeting as the real Elsevier, but in a kind of satiric way. Fake Elsevier has gotten a lot of attention in our circles. I think recently fake Elsevier attracted more followers than the real Elsevier itself. And so fake Elsevier has been kind of a thorn in Elsevier's side for the last couple of months since it launched. And I guess last week, fake Elsevier was served with a notification from Twitter saying that they were that fake Elsevier was violating Elsevier's trademark. Have you been following this story, Dan?
I mean, you know, I think fake Elsevier has done a good job sort of being a thorn in the side of Elsevier, and the Elsevier, I just think, you know, this is like, There's no hope to win at these sorts of things. I mean, this is one of these cases where parody and shame are really effective against large companies that are doing things that their consumers don't like. Evidently what happened, and if you sort of trace back the tweets back and forth between fake Elsevier and real Elsevier and Tom Reller, who's an executive at Elsevier, fake Elsevier, you know, sort of tweeted that they had gotten this takedown notice for a trademark violation. And Tom Reller was sort of incredulous, this executive from Elsevier. But then it actually did turn out that, and this is often the case, they're this sort of legal department that's a little bit, you know, operating under legal principles, which is you just sort of go after every use of the mark on the internet. And they actually had sent fake Elsevier a notice about this. And I just think this is one of those cases where the real Elsevier should just, like, you know, as best as it can, just stay quiet, you know?
Yeah.
There's no winning strategy. There's no winning PR strategy. And it says something kind of bad for Elsevier that fake Elsevier has more followers on Twitter than the real Elsevier. To just keep the story alive in a sense and rile people up again, it seems like a really – bad unforced error by the Elsevier legal department. So, I think at this point, Elsevier should just kind of go underground and, you know, do the best they can to promote their open access initiatives, what meager initiatives they are, and, you know, just try to ride it out. But I think you're going to have a hard time doing that because FERPA, the kind of anti-Research Works Act, the act that's now making its way through Congress that actually puts in a strong mandate for open access for publicly funded research, seems to be getting a little bit of traction. And so I think at some point they're going to have to, wade back into this debate, and fake Elsevier will be there ready to razz them for it.
Yeah. You know, yeah, on the other side of this story is the Washington Post had a story this past week about, sort of fake president accounts for college and university presidents here in the Washington area. And the university presidents around here have all taken the attitude that Dan has just suggested, which is, this is funny. And, you know, it's why would I stomp on this? It's just funny.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, it reminds me a little bit of that story we mentioned briefly a couple of weeks ago about Western Kentucky, thinking about having a policy that you can't make fun of the university on social media. And I mean, again, it's exactly that same kind of ridiculous ridiculous move that we've seen play out so badly so many times. I mean, there's even a word for this, you know, the Streisand effect, where you try to shut down conversation online that, you know, or whatever, you know, online thing it is, because you don't, you know, and then what that does is to draw even more attention to it than was given to it before. So, yeah.
Kind of the Santorum, the Santorum effect also.
I know in copyright law, right, there's an exception for satire. Is that true of trademark law as well? I mean, is it, Twitter can sort of do whatever it wants to. It's its own platform. It owns the platform. If it wants to kick somebody off, fine. But I mean, in terms of legalities, like, does Elsevier like have any kind of a case against fake Elsevier? I mean, do people
know? I don't know. No, there may be some difference between Europe and the U.S. on this too, right?
Right. Yes. True. Right. Right. Right.
Right. And it depends on what. Yeah. Exactly. And I have to say that when I saw, you know, and again, what happened was that, you know, these flunkies in the legal department at Elsevier complained to Twitter, and then Twitter sent a notice to fake Elsevier, right? And then, you know, Elsevier, you know, investigated and found that yes, indeed, it had issued this. And again, to Elsevier's credit, they seem to have more or less withdrawn. Certainly Tom Reller has said, look, we totally acknowledge the right of this account to exist. This was a mistake, you know, bad communication, you know, from one department to another. So, I mean, it doesn't look like fake Elsevier is going anywhere anytime soon. I'd say when I first read that they had gotten this notice, I thought that it was aimed specifically at fake Elsevier's avatar, which is visually very similar to Elsevier's actual logo. But when you sort of blow it up and look at it in a higher resolution, you see that it is in fact a totally, you know, it's an original drawing that is itself a satirical drawing. So it's not just Elsevier's logo that they're using, which I think would be a legitimate trademark violation. It's a, you know, the picture is satiric as well, as the account. So, I don't think Elsevier has a leg to stand on, and I don't think this is going to go anywhere. So that's a good thing.
Well, I know I will continue to follow fake Elsevier as long as it's in business. It's a hilarious parody, and I think
Are you on the enemies list?
I haven't even checked if I'm on the enemies list. I doubt I am.
You should get on that.
Yeah, I should.
I think we should all be on it.
Yes, I would like to be on the enemies list. Fake Elsevier, like if you're listening.
It's like on being on the U Da City enemies list.
Well, I think that's like a party of one.
I was going to say, me and two other people. There have to be at least two other people. You know, they have to.
It's not really an enemies list if it's just a list of one.
An enemies plaque.
Yes, Richard Nixon would be disappointed. Well, we will continue to advocate for being on the enemies list. Elsevier, if you're listening, put us on.
Tom,
Mills.
I actually have a comment and then a question. The
sure.
comment is, I think it's really interesting as I've been listening to us talk today. Very interested by the fact that we've done basically a whole podcast talking about monopolistic corporations, and we never mentioned one. Can anybody guess which one that is?
Does it start with a G and end with an E?
I think it does. Quite interesting, you know.
Don't say the word.
But I'm proud of us. So that's the comment. And then the question is actually a leftover from our previous podcast. And Dan, you have to tell the truth. Have you purchased the newest iPad?
Oh no, I have not. I have.
Okay.
I have, just checking. Promise. Although I broke my iPhone yet again, and wow. I was thinking of actually getting one of these Windows phones. But I didn't.
Oh, interesting. I mean, they are beautiful. Well, I was actually, we were, Sheila Brennan at the center, our colleague, was just tweeting. She's wondering what kind of, she's got an iPhone. She's wondering what kind of tablet to get. She doesn't maybe want to get an iPad because she says it's just a big iPhone and I've already got one of those. What should I get? And I actually, I'm holding out myself for the Windows tablet in the fall. I actually think that there's, you know, that's going to be something to watch. But we'll hold that idea, we'll hold that thought for the next edition of Digital Campus.
thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.